الحمد لله الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونؤمن به ونتوكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلله فلا هادي له ونشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له ونشهد أن سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا محمدًا عبده ورسوله صلى الله تعالى عليه وعلى آله وصحبه وبارك وسلم تسليمًا كثيرًا كثيرًا أما بعد فقد قال تعالى في القرآن المجيد والفرقان الحميد ولا تركنوا إلى الذين ظلموا فتمسكم النار صدق الله صدق الله العظيم.
My respected ulama, my elders and my brothers in Islam, as the ummah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, every single one of us look back at the sahaba radiallahu anhum and we feel honored to attribute ourselves to these great individuals. These people who are blessed to be the greatest of mankind after the Anbiya alayhimus salam. Furthermore, when we look at the Sahaba radiallahu anhum and the manner in which not once but on multiple occasions they stood on the battlefield against the forces of kufr, the forces of disbelief, and despite the odds being heavily against them, they still triumphed and they were still victorious, we marvel. We look at the Battle of Badr. Sahaba radiallahu anhum, numbering plus minus 313 in number. The Kuffar 1,000 in number. A force to be reckoned with, armed to the teeth. Yet the help of Allah Ta'ala comes and Sahaba radiallahu anhum are victorious. And when we examine incidents of this nature, perhaps one incident that stands out among the rest is the Battle of Yarmouk. In this battle, Sahaba radiallahu anhum were just 40,000 in number. And the army of Rome was 240,000 in number. If anyone has to examine the odds will work out to 1 to 6. Every single Sahabi would have to face and contend with 6 kuffar on his own. Yet here also Allah Ta'ala helps them as they triumphed against the kuffar and they were victorious. Now when we look back at the victories of Sahaba radiallahu anhum, then their victories on the battlefield definitely stand out. But there is another victory of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum which is perhaps very often overlooked. And in some aspects, perhaps it is even greater than the victory on the battlefield of war. Because it was another battlefield altogether, the battlefield of identity. A very great alim of the past, Sayyid Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi rahimahullah, mentioned. He says that Sahaba radiallahu anhum, let us look at the lifestyle, the society, the civilization from which they hailed. They came from a Bedouin lifestyle. There's nothing at all glamorous about that lifestyle. They were not people of excessive wealth. In fact, in many ways, they were considered to be a downtrodden civilization. They would bury their daughters alive, spend great amounts of time intoxicated. They had feudal wars between tribes that would drag on for more than 100 years. What was great about this civilization? Nothing. They seemed to be a backward civilization. In wealth, they had no progress. In technology, they had no progress. In culture, they seemed to have no progress. Before Islam, obviously. And who are the superpowers of that time? Rome and Persia. It has been mentioned regarding the Persians and the Romans that they had so much of wealth that if a Persian man wore a hat that cost less than 50,000 silver coins, the noble class would laugh at him and would not allow him to sit in their gatherings. It was too cheap. When Sahaba radiallahu anhum began to spread the borders of Islam and they now met these people and they now encountered these civilizations, There was a clash of cultures. Sahaba radiallahu anhum saw some things that they had never seen before in their life in terms of technology and progress. The books of history have testified and said that one occasion Sahaba radiallahu anhum sat to eat in the lands of the disbelievers and roti bread was placed before them. What was the bread of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam? The hadith describes and says that it would be ground, the wheat would be ground, but the chaff would not be sifted out, it would be put in. فَيَنْفُخُ فِيهِ فَيَطِيرُ مَطَارٍ. They would just blow and whatever chaff came out, it was very coarse bread. The bread of the kuffar was so fine and so thin, Sahaba radiallahu anhum thought it was serviettes. Sahaba radiallahu anhum knew what camphor was, kafur. But the camphor in the lands of the disbelievers was so refined that Sahaba radiallahu anhum thought it to be milk, thought it to be salt, and they put it in the food by mistake. Yet despite coming across all this wealth and this opulence and this glamour, this glamorous lifestyle, Sahaba radiallahu anhum did not change one bit. The Islam remained the same Islam. The sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam remained in their lives. They did not change in the least. When Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam went to perform Umrah, and the kuffar barred him from entering Makkah Mukarramah, and the treaty of Hudaybiyah thereafter ensued and took place. On that occasion, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam wanted to send an ambassador of the Muslims to the kuffar to speak on behalf of the Muslims and explain that we have only come to perform Umrah, we have not come for any alternate purpose. He asked Hazrat Umar radiallahu anhu to go. Hazrat Umar radiallahu anhu explains and says, Mali bi Makkah min Ashira. O Rasul of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, I'm going to be entering enemy territory and I do not have any family in Makkah. So I will be at risk, my life will be threatened. So Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam asks Hazrat Uthman radiallahu anhu to go because he had family members who could protect him in Makkah, although it was enemy territory. Uthman radiallahu anhu goes. The kuffar do not receive him well. Asa'u lahul qawl, abithu bih. They trouble him, did not speak to him well. Thumma ajarahu ibn ammi, Aban ibn Sa'id ibn al-As. His cousin thereafter takes him into his protection and he says, never mind, you stay with me, I will look after you. But when he comes to stay with his cousin looks at him and gets a surprise. His cousin tells him that, oh my cousin, ma li araka mutahashifa. That, oh Uthman, oh my cousin, what is the matter with you? Why are you dressed in this disrespectful manner? You are not dressed appropriately. Asbil, put your pants below your ankles. At that time, the kuffar, the respectable way of dressing according to them was for a person's pants to be below the ankles. Wakana izaru Uthman radiallahu an ila nisfi saqay. The pants of Hazrat Uthman radiallahu an was between the ankle and the knee, halfway between at the shin. Now let us look at Hazrat Uthman radiallahu anhu's position. He is an ambassador of the Muslims. The Umrah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam is at stake. If it was you or I in that position, perhaps our reaction would be, never mind, it's a small thing, put the pants down, they'll get happy. Perhaps they will look at us favorably and they will allow all the Muslims to perform Umrah. It's a minor sacrifice for a greater objective. Perhaps that is what you and I would say. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. Never mind, it's a small thing, it's just the pants below the ankles. Uthman radiallahu anhu was not apologetic. He was not embarrassed and he did not do anything to please them. His simple answer, Hakada izratu sahibina sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. This is how Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam wears his lower garment. If you like it, good for you. If you don't like it, that's your problem. I'm not going to change for you. Let us examine the lives of the Muslims in relation to that. Today, if somebody is working in a corporate environment, the dress code of the workplace is a suit and tie. He thinks to himself, my job is on the line. If I do not toe the line, I will not be able to secure promotion, a pay raise. Never mind, let me just go with the flow. Then if his boss tells him, go and meet a certain client in the casino, he'll be prepared to do it. Why? It's my pay on the line, my job on the line. If he has to meet a woman, a strange woman, and sit with her somewhere, even if it means sitting with her in a haram restaurant where there's alcohol at the table, in the name of a business meeting, he'll be prepared to do it. And that's just because of his job and money. Uthman radiallahu anhu is telling us that even if the umrah of the Muslims is at stake, the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam is greater. Not when in Rome, do as the Romans do. No matter where you are, do as Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam did. Sahaba radiallahu anhum were so firm in the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam and the way of Islam, that no matter where they went in the world, no matter what they saw, no matter who they met, they did not change. Rather, those around them changed and began to follow Islam. Can any of us claim that today it is the same? Let us just look, and you can testify to the same thing. Look at certain countries to which Islam had spread. Even today, after all these years, the influence of Sahaba can be seen to some degree. If we look at Egypt, in the architecture, you will see the architecture of Sahaba radiallahu anhum. You look at the language, Arabic. You go to Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Ethiopia, Senegal, Somalia, Kenya, so many of these countries. If their language is not Arabic, then a great amount of the native language will contain Arabic. Did these people not have a language before Sahaba came to them? And obviously when Sahaba radiallahu anhum came to them, Sahaba would be the minority. They were coming from a foreign land. Yet, Sahaba radiallahu anhum were so firm in their way of Islam, that people around them were impressed with this Islam. They said, let us change and accept the way of Islam. Our language will change and become the language of the Muslims. Our dress will change and become the dress of the Muslims. Today people around the world are pining to speak the English language and dress like the English. It has entirely changed. Maqil bin Yasar radiallahu anhu, Sahabi of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, بينما يتغدى, once he's eating, إِذْ سَقَطَتْ مِنْهُ لُقْمَةً, a morsel falls onto the floor. Without thinking twice, فَتَنَاوَلَهَا, he picks it up. فَأَمَاطَ مَا كَانَ فِيهَا مِنْ أَذَى, he cleans the dirt of this morsel, فَأَكَلَهَا, and he eats it. A perfectly natural, spontaneous reaction. Pick it up and eat it. فَتَغَامَزَ بِهِ الدَّهَاقِينَ, the kuffar who were present on that occasion, who were the nobles of the time, the so-called upper class of society, they begin to glare at him. That you are behaving in this low manner. You are eating off the floor. So somebody says to him, أَصْلَحَ اللَّهُ الْأَمِيرُ, may Allah Ta'ala keep our leader well, O Maqil bin Yasar. إِنَّ هَؤُلَاءِ الدَّهَاقِينَ يَتَغَامَزُونَ, these kuffar who are seated here, they are glaring at you. They are unhappy with you. Why? مِنْ أَخْذِكَ اللُّقْمَةِ وَبَيْنَ يَدَيْكَ هَذَا الطَّعَامِ, why do you have to eat from the floor when there is so much of food in front of you? You are behaving like a beggar, like a pauper, like a poor person. Maqil bin Yasar radiallahu anhu is not bothered in the least by what the kuffar have to think about it. He says, إِنِّي لَمْ أَكُنْ لِأَدَعَ مَا سَمِعْتُ مِنْ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ لِهَاؤُلَاءِ الْأَعَاجِمِ, why should I abandon the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam for them? If they like the sunnah, that is to their benefit. If they don't like it, it's their problem. Why must I change for them? I know the value of the sunnah. He says, كُنَّا نَأْمُرُ أَحَدَنَا إِذَا سَقَطَتْ لُقْمَتُهُ أَيَّأْخُذَهَا وَيُمِيطَ مَا كَانَ فِيهَا مِنْ أَذَى وَيَأْكُلَهَا وَلَا يَدَعَهَا لِلشَّيْطَانِ. He says it is the way of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum and the teaching of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that when somebody's morsel falls on the floor, he should not leave it for shaitan. He should pick it up and if possible clean it and eat it. This is the teaching of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that we should show appreciation to Allah for even that morsel. Do not take it for granted. Even that is a ni'mat of Allah which we need. And today we have become ashamed of our Islam. It is a reality that if a person is in the airport sometimes, he feels shy to call out the adhan and read salah. What if people look at me, what will they think? Sometimes he's in the bathroom of the airport, he needs to perform wudu. He is shy to take his foot and wash it in the sink. People will say, I'm dirty, I'm putting my foot in the sink. Why do we not think to ourselves that kafir who is standing, urinating openly at the urinal for the whole world to see and does not clean himself when he is not shy to be filthy in public? Why am I shy to be clean in public? I am ashamed to be clean. So I must make myself dirty like him. Is this the way that a Muslim will think? But today we have become ashamed of Islam, so this has become our response. When Sahaba radiallahu anhum fled from Makkah Mukarramah on the first hijrat to Abyssinia, to Habasha, the kuffar could not bear to see that they had escaped persecution and torture. They sent Amr bin As, who was not yet a Muslim at that time, and Umara bin Sa'id, another kafir, to Najashi, the king of Abyssinia. They said, "You go and by hook or by crook, you tell him that these people are fugitives because they have broken the law and they are wanted in our country, they are evil people. You tell him that he must send them back. Extradition, he must extradite them back to Makkah Mukarramah." Sahaba radiallahu anhu, Ma'im Abyssinia, Abdullah bin Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, Uthman radiallahu anhu, Uthman bin Maz'un radiallahu anhu, Ja'far bin Abi Talib radiallahu anhu, all these Sahaba are there. They hear that the two kafirs, the envoy of the Quraysh, have come. When they came, what did they do? The first thing they did, the ministers of Najashi, they bribed them all. They gave them abundant gifts. You make sure, you whisper in Najashi's ears that he looks at us favorably, he takes our side. And then they want to play to Najashi's tune to make him happy. It was the protocol of the court of Najashi that when anybody enters, they had to prostrate and make sajda before him. When they entered, they did that as well. And they give Najashi the concocted story, their lies. They say, "These are people who cause fitna and fasad in our country. They came to your country, they are going to corrupt your society as well. To save yourself, send them back with us." Najashi says, "I will give them a hearing first." He sends for them. Ja'far radiallahu anhu says, "Ana khatibukum al-yawm." Today I will speak on behalf of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum. When they come, they do not make sajda before the king. Understand how precarious their situation was. If Najashi was not going to be happy with them, was not going to look at them favorably, he was going to deport them to Makkah Mukarramah, where their lives and their iman was at stake and was being threatened. They were being tortured. The torture of the Quraysh, we do not need to elaborate on it, well known to one and all. In that situation, if it was you and I, we'd be prepared to outright lie. We think, it's my life or lying, what's more valuable? We think, how can I risk my safety? A person would be prepared to do anything to secure his safety. But Sahaba radiallahu anhum don't even prostrate. Immediately those ministers of Najashi cause a big uproar. And they say, "Ma laka la tasjud lil malak." What's wrong with you people? You are not prostrating before the king. And they make a big issue out of it. Sahaba radiallahu anhum give a simple, straightforward answer. No need to be apologetic, no need to beat around the bush. This is our Islam. Inna la nasjudu illa lillah. We only make sajda to Allah. You are not Allah, no sajda for you, sorry. You like it or you don't like it, that's your problem. This is my Islam. I follow the deen of Islam. I will not change for anyone else. So they asked them, "Why do you only prostrate to Allah?" "Inna Allah ba'atha ilayna rasulahu sallallahu alayhi wa sallam fa'amarana alla nasjuda illa lillah." Simple. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam told us that we should only make sajda to Allah. So we only make sajda to Allah. There's no need for more explanation than that. This is our deen of Islam. When Najashi saw how firm these people were on their deen of Islam, his heart melted. He became sympathetic towards them. These two people who were trying to bribe him, he told them, "Take all your gifts back. I don't want anything from you when you leave." And he told these people, "You can stay here safely." And he himself accepts Islam. Respected brothers and elders, psychologists explain there is a concept known as enculturation. Enculturation is where a person abandons his own way of life, his own culture, his own values, for the way of life and the value system of some foreign people. And there are different reasons why people will abandon their own way for the way of other people. The same historian whom we refer to, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Ali Nadwi rahimahullah, he mentioned that Sahaba radiallahu anhum and the Muslim Ummah kept a strong lifestyle of Islam for 600 years until the Tartars came and overthrew the Muslim Ummah. Thereafter, the Islam still remained in some way until World War I. When the Khilafat fell after World War I, he says, now you can go to any country in the world, even if it's called a Muslim country. He says, but when you look around, besides the Adhan, besides the Masajid, and some Arabic writing that you may see, you can see no difference between this country and any European or Western country. If you see movies, cinemas and theatres, you'll see same cinemas and theatres elsewhere. If you see casinos here, you see casinos there. If you see women dressed indecently here, you are seeing the same thing there. Where is the difference? We do not need to step into these countries. Let us step into our own homes and try and see where is the Islam. In many cases, if it is not for a frame on the wall that is written Hamim La Yunsurun, or it is not for some Quran Sharif lying on the shelf, there will be no semblance of Islam in our homes. Leave our homes, look into the mirror. It happened to me personally, where a person came and fought with me. You have pride in your heart. I said, that is probably true, but how do you know that? He says, you did not make salam to me. I tell him, forgive me. I do not want to make him angry. But how was I supposed to know he is a Muslim? To me, he looked like any kafir. That is the reality. He did not have the topi of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The beard of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he did not have. He was dressed in a suit and tie. How am I supposed to know he is a Muslim? As a Muslim, we do not make salam to a kafir. How can you wish peace to a man who is at war with Allah? This enculturation comes about because we are embarrassed of Islam. We feel that Islam is a backward way. We feel that eating with our fingers is backwards. This is a knife and fork that is progressive. We are ashamed of the way of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We feel that he's only in the way of dress, the way of life, the holidays, going to the bank. We feel that is what will make us happy and bring us success. We are embarrassed of Islam. A person will feel shy to raise his pants below his ankles. He's shy, he's embarrassed. What will people think? Why do we not think, what will Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam think? Whose heart do we want to make happy? The heart of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or the hearts of these people who do not even have Islam? Respected brothers and elders, the need of the time is to bring this Islam alive. In our mindset, up till now we have discussed the aspects of Islam that relate to the external. What about my Islamic identity in my mindset? Are we thinking like Muslims, or who are we thinking like? Let us take the typical example of the Muslim child today. There are many Muslim children today who go to non-Muslim schools. The schooling starts at the age of 6. Before that, for 2 or 3 years, perhaps even to some Montessori or preschool. 7 years of junior school in a Christian environment, non-Islamic environment. In the afternoon, there is no maktab madrasa. Why? Extramural activities, extracurricular activities or sport. Then he goes to high school, it's the same story. The father does not take him to the masjid because in many cases, the father himself is not in the masjid. There is no deen in the home, there is no ta'aleem in the home, no recitation of Quran in the home. Let us ask ourselves, what Islam will this child have? What Islam will this child have? Many Muslims are those who come for Jummah. At least once a week they have some connection with Islam. This child is in school at the time of Jummah. Even that he does not have. Then he goes to university. And the seeds are planted of Darwin's theory, of gender equality, of LGBT and other filthy things. And then he takes it hook, line and sinker and he leaves the fold of Islam. And then we want to cry and say, where did this come from? The Islamic identity was not created within that child. Respected brothers and elders, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam has given us glad tidings. مَنْ تَمَسَّكَ بِسُنَّتِي إِنْدَ فَسَادِ أُمَّتِي فَلَهُ أَجْرُ مِئَةِ شَهِيدٍ رواه البيهقي رحمة الله عليه. Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, those people of my ummah who hold fast to my sunnah, the way of Islam, they preserve the Islamic identity in all facets of their life at a time when the condition of the ummah is deteriorating as we see it around us today. That person Blessed is that person, he will have the reward of 100 martyrs. May Allah Ta'ala grant us one in all tawfiq to bring this ta'aleem alive in our homes, to attach ourselves to the masjid, to get this deen in the lives of our children, and to try and bring deen alive in every facet of our lives. It starts off with one small step, but if we take that step, Allah Ta'ala will see us favorably and assist us to take the other steps. The initiative has to come from our side first of all. May Allah Ta'ala guide us one and all. Wa akhir da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin.